TV Drama Podcast. I'm Scott, and with me this evening, the smooth-speaking Bigfoot to my marble-mouthed, oh my god, it hurts so bad, why the hell am I podcasting foot? It's Brian. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Scott. Scott, for the listener, Scott's pulling a Kurt Schilling and is playing through the pain with an injured foot, so...
Kurt, of all people to be compared to, but yes. Although, basically, Yankee fans will note that Luke Voit had played the last like 2 months of the season hobbling around on a bad foot, and I related that because I've been hobbling around for months now on a bad foot. But yeah, I had, long story short, because that's not why people want to listen to this podcast, I had surgery on Friday, where there were bones broken and chopped out and titanium pieces replaced and inserted. So I'm in a little bit of pain. So.
But he's playing through.
Oh, yeah. I took my Percocet an hour or two ago. It's working to a certain degree. And so if you should hear me wince or go, it's not because I'm reacting to the podcast. I'm just reacting to a twinge in my foot. But as you said, Brian, we are here to talk about the latest episode of Fargo, The Pretend War. Another episode written by Noah Hawley. I'm almost curious to take a long view look at the series this year and see if he's actually done the writing credits for all the episodes or not. I doubt it, but you never know. It's been a while. I know the woman who directed last week's episode, I think, directed this one as well. I don't have her name in front of me. It's one of those weird Diabetha kind of names or something. That's why people come to our podcast to hear me butcher the names of directors.
I want to say it's Dierbla Watson, but...
Yeah, you're right. Dierbla Walsh, actually.
Walsh. Yeah, Irish director. Right.
So, yes, it's the 4th episode of the season of season 4. So let's get right to it. So, and I actually had to speak to you for briefly before we even started recording tonight, because I actually was, you know, maybe it's the Percocet. I was a little confused at the opening moments of the show, where I think we were going on a little guided tour of the instruments in the morgue. And we go up the stairs to, is it Ethelreda?
Yep.
But then she looks, I think she's like, is it, she looks out the door and she sees someone sitting or standing by the landing. Is that where that was happening? Or is that another room? I can't recall right now.
It looked like someone sitting on the stairway.
Yeah. So that's what I thought, sitting on the landing. And it's really kind of a brief moment where she's obviously frightened or startled or whatever. And we cut away from it. We do see something which I guess connects to this much later in the episode when it's, is it Zelmer? Is that her name?
Yeah, Zelmer and Swanee.
Yeah, Zelmer and Swanee. Oh, by the way, I just realized Zelmer's last name is Roulette. Come on. The names of these characters. Come on. Really? Roulette? Anyway, I'm sorry. It's a great name. I love it. It's just, it's... Yeah. So when she is literally laundering the money, although apparently not doing that great a job of it since it still, I guess, smells like puke or whatever, unless people are smelling whatever it is she's using, but I'm still thinking it's the puke that they're smelling, whatever. But later in that scene, we see someone or something rising from the bathtub, and then then we can see it's a man, and he walks over to Swanee's bedside, and it had all the look and feel as if, oh, this is death. And I'm thinking that's who we also saw sitting on the landing at the beginning of the episode, which, you know, if we go with the idea that it's, you know, supposed to symbolize death, well, that is a funeral home with a morgue, so it would make some sense, or maybe more of a specter of things to come. Death is going to come here because, you know, it's Fargo. people are going to start dying on this show pretty soon, I'm pretty sure. So that was the way Mai took it. It was just, I'm not really sure if we needed it, but with Holly, we tend to allow him his excesses at times, so I'll be fine with it, I guess.
Well, we did wonder. Every season has had some dabble of the supernatural, and yes. And this was our first peek at the supernatural, and it was foretold by, I think, Swanee talking about the ghosts at the kitchen table before eating the pie or while eating the pie. So,
right.
we wondered if we would see some supernatural element, and it is finally introduced in this episode.
Oh, okay. That makes perfect sense. You're right. We've had our supernatural elements. We've had our science fiction elements. It's always possible in Fargo. Who knew? Back in 1996, who knew? So then we get a scene where I guess they rob Constant Calamita and whoever the guy with him in the truck was. They rob him of a shipment of guns. So we get a literal ring of fire, and I'm so tempted to do a little Johnny Cash, but I'm not going to. And speaking of ring of fire, he actually gets a little ring of fire, like, imprinted on his cheek by the heated up barrel of a shotgun or a rifle, I guess. So, I did enjoy that. I'm almost surprised they didn't shoot him. they set the other guy on. The other guy got set on fire, who was like a schmuck, and I don't think he was anybody. But the guy that they kind of had heard had been one of the people taking a shot at his kid, you think that would have been the one they would have set on fire?
Yeah, I think that was strategic, both to send a message and to say, let's not go to war, all-out war yet. Right. But and that precedes the conversation between the senator and Violante.
Right. Because once again, they meet. And I was very happy that later in the episode, Violante actually referred to Dr. Senator as the consigliere. So now I feel validated by using that term, even though we all know that that's the term. We've all seen The Godfather. We know that's the right word. And it's very clear from that conversation that Violante has not been aware of what's been going on, whether it be the hit that was called by Gaetano. And there's no reason he would know anything about the two women who had robbed him, because it has absolutely nothing to do with them. It was just a wacky coincidence of timing, I guess. So later, when we see Loy Cannon and they're actually going through the big haul of guns that were stolen from the Fadas, this was kind of one of the moments that kind of hit my ear and made me kind of go Google something. When he mentioned that with 300 guns that they had gotten, I think they're 300 like semi-automatics, they're going to sell 200 of them to Mort Kellerman out of Fargo. The moment I hear that, I'm like, okay, I know that name. Let me go look up. It's got to be from a previous season and what the connection has to be, you know, the history of some other character or something. So for those of you who are into Fargo, and I guess you are if you're listening to this podcast, but you don't remember who that is, I will now just, this is taken directly from the Fargo wiki. Kellerman, that he was pretty much had become a major player in Fargo, the North Dakota, the underworld by the late 1940s. He was a rival of Dieter Gerhardt, who was the leader of the Gerhardt crime syndicate. That was the family that a lot of season two was based around. So I think there were some things we might have seen in some flashback stories that were told during season two, because there is definitely a big scene between Kellerman and Dieter Gerhardt when he retires, when he's passing the reins to Otto, and he ends up being the one who brutally murders Dieter in 1951, shooting him in the head 19 times. And then later on, Kellerman is going to see a screening of, it's the movie they keep referencing, Moonbase Freedom, starring Ronald Reagan. and yada, yada, yada. Eventually, Dodd, we all remember Dodd Gerhardt, is the one who actually stabs him in the back of the head and kills him. So that was, so Mort Kellerman does connect directly to season two. So I like that we're getting these nice little connections to different seasons.
Yeah, I like that too, and to go along with the theme of this season about sort of a rumination on what it means to be an American and an immigrant, I would backtrack just to what Violante says to Dr. Senator about American values, that he understands money and he understands family, but he understands what it is to be an American. And he says to pretend to be something that you are, when in fact America has a history of, I think he says, slavery and smallpox blankets, but aspires to these values. And then they talk about, are we at war or are we not at war? And Dr. Senator has the great line where he says, we're not, but we're trying hard to be. Sort of two groups who at that time, as we've said before, Italian Americans were somewhat marginalized and pushed to the underworld before becoming legitimate. And both that conversation between two groups of people, both fighting for legitimacy. So I thought that was a great scene between the two of them.
Oh, yeah. Definitely a great scene. And it's funny just hearing him talk about Americans and what it means to be an American is to pretend to be something you're not. And
right.
When he's talking, obviously he's talking, and as you said, he makes reference to the atrocities up to that point in history or whatever. And I remember as I was watching, I was thinking, yeah, he's right. And like, and that really just pertains to just our identity as people, even to this day. I mean, what is social media, if not a major form of most people trying to pretend to be something they're not? What is an Instagram account, if not that? What is our avatar, if not that? You know, it's the way our society has always moved. I mean, it may be the case to a certain degree in other countries, but none more than America. It's what we are. We are the land of pretend. We're the place with Hollywood, you know, so it makes perfect sense. And no matter how you want to look at it. Oh, and by the way, just to throw in one other thing. It's actually the following scene. So I guess I'll go back to it now. The only thing I wanted to mention about the other thing about Loy Cannon, just want to give myself a pat on the back, because then when they refer to the two women, he calls them two Bonnies, as in Bonnie and Clyde. And I went, hey, I was using a Bonnie and Clyde thing about them in the podcast the other week. So look at me, I'm so smart. Anyway.
So, nailed it.
This working? Okay. Anyway.
Well, I like where Loy says when they're talking about both the hit and the two women to throw off, maybe, and Dr. Senator proposes maybe to throw them off that it was women. And I like Loy's line. He says, no, that doesn't make sense because nobody is both dumb and smart at the same time.
Right. Yeah.
So you see, Loy's a pretty astute observer.
He is, but I will say, I believe I am the exception to your rule, sir. I believe I am the exception to your rule. I am dumb and smart often at the same time. You know what I did today? I'm wearing a surgical boot on my left foot. I figured out a way to stub my right toe on my left toe, my left foot's boot. I slammed it into the other. Who does that? Because if you think about the process of it, like, that shouldn't even be possible. How'd you slam your toe into your other foot? I found a way to do it. Because, you know, I marvel at my stupidity. It's brilliant. Anyway, the next, because this is a very briskly paced episode, so we can just like kind of zip through it. Next scene is kind of a bit of a fun one because we've got and I think we haven't resolved how to pronounce his name yet, but I've been saying Josto and Orietta. Well, they're sexing it up, and she's introducing him to the wonderful world of being choked during sex. I'm not going to talk too much more about that because I'll get myself in trouble. But I do something. Just say it's usually not me. Anyway, I did find it interesting that they could start incorporating kink like that into their sex, but they stay almost completely dressed.
Yeah. Yeah, very much buttoned up, and afterwards, you know, Orietta still is focused on propriety of his language and his behavior.
Oh,
and
absolutely,
very odd.
And there's a little exchange that you knew that I had to make a reference to it. I mean, because how can I not? when she's talking about Istanbul, and she says, "I think that's where they filmed Casablanca." And he's like, "No, they filmed Casablanca in Casablanca." And I'm sitting there, I'm like going, "No." They filmed, you know full well they filmed it on a back lot in Hollywood, motherfucker.
It's two people who both try to pretend to be smarter than they are.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. Love the fr Oh, and by the way, I almost wish I was a Coke user because I want to be able to use the phrase "fluffy whiz bang" as often as possible. In fact, if I hadn't come up with the foot thing in the opening, "Fluffy Whiz Bang" should have been one of the intro names this week. Maybe it'll be for a future one. I mean, there's so much great about that phrase. Oh my God, that sh I sh I want to type that into Pornhub and see what comes up with it.
I don't recommend that.
Yeah, maybe it's something if you Google it. There's a lot of bad possible words there. Got whiz. Oh wait. Anyway, so Ethelreda pops over, I guess, hoping to do some chores. I love it. There's still that weird relationship between her and Arietta. I mean, we know that's kind of what inspired Arietta to bring over the pie. So it's a very strange relationship, you know? Because it's almost like she's admiring and resentful all at the same time. So there's it's a weird, almost kind of competitive thing. I don't know how else to put it. It's a very strange dynamic. It's probably one of the most unique things on the show, I would say.
Now, you see, there's some contempt and admiration she has for Ethelreda that that manifests in a very strange way, and is very trusting to leave her alone in her apartment, you know, with just having met her. But then we see, which becomes bigger in the episode, we see there's a room Ethelreda's not supposed to go into, which instantly piques our interest.
Now, was she told not to go in that room, or she just or was it just locked and she figured out a way to open it? I don't recall that
Sh
aspect.
she told her to do those rooms and do the bedroom. And when Ethelreda's going down the hall, she starts to turn toward the room. She goes, "Oh, no need to go in that room."
Oh,
And
that's right. Okay.
so I don't think she locked it, but I think she short made it clear, just do the bedroom and in the front part of the apartment.
Right, and that's where she finds like the secret stash of like the poisons and the other toxic items. But then, as she unintentionally, I think it's from when she knocks over a box or whatever, that's when she becomes aware of all the other things in there that which are basically mementos of all of Arietta's murders. You know, either being the little obituary clippings and different items, like I guess probably all the veterans that she's killed. So there's all the medals from. You start to get the idea, like, oh. She's been doing this for a while.
Yep, Angel of Death.
True angel of death. And of course, she finds, Ethelreda finds that ring that we know is going to play a big part somewhere. It's just going to keep finding its way, you know, until it gets thrown into the volcano or something. Wait, wrong thing. Yeah, so she, and I believe she, and she leaves with, she takes the ring. She leaves her book there, though, doesn't she?
Yeah, I think she took one of the books from the front room in there with her and set it down when everything happened, and I think she forgets to take it out.
Oh, is that what it was? It wasn't her own, but she's still something that shouldn't have been there, and the only way it could have been there is if she'd. Okay, because I remember seeing that.
I could be wrong, but she was carrying something in there, and then all that happened, and it looks like in the haste to get out,
Yes.
she set something down. So it was either one of the books she said could be borrowed, or maybe her notebook where she was told what to do. So it's going to obviously tip
Right.
Orietta off as to what's
Either
happened.
way, it's going to tip her off to that she's been in there, which is going to, well, maybe she'll make her a special cupcake or something. So flipping back to the story of the episode, we get this nice little, well, actually, it's not that nice a scene. The rabbi finally is able to meet up with Jostow outside, and he tells him about that attempt that they had made on Lemuel's life. which have obviously sets Jostow off a bit. Which leads to later on, Jostow actually confronts Gaetano and I would say his disloyal men. It's an interesting standoff because I'll give Jostow seemed a bit more with it than I would have expected. You know, he may very well have, you know, pulled the trigger on Gaetano's balls there. However, my problem with what happens here is, yeah, you've got that initial confrontation. And he takes, you know, shots out of, you know, in the room. But there's no real punishment or consequences. And I felt there kind of should have been.
I thought that, too. And he did the most dangerous thing you could do, and that is to humiliate someone like Gaetano. You know, he not only didn't punish him, he also further enraged him.
Yeah.
Which endangers him even more. To do it in front of everybody. And I also thought, to me, you know, he still let Gaetano get awful close with that big knife.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I would have let him make his way around that table and get that close. But I agree with you. Jostow was more that's the most spine we've seen him have in a direct one-on-one confrontation.
Right. But my concern for him is one of your main guys, and I'm referring to Constant here, had no problem switching over to follow his brother's directive and to kill and to try to take out Loy's son, which you knew full well is going to set off a huge war. Don't trust that guy. Me personally, that guy is killed. Then you whack him. You get rid of him. Tony Soprano would not let that guy walk out of that room alive, you know, or pick any other fictional mobster or gangster, whatever, you know. Even Nicky, what's Nicky's last name in Boardwalk Empire, would not have let that go down. And I'm going, oh, you're not taking care of business here, dude. And you're still freaking talking about killing that goddamn doctor still, which was totally inconsequential. So we'll see. I don't have a good feeling about that.
I will say it remains to be seen, because when he gets in the car after talking to Rabbi Milligan, he does say, "Don't worry about Calamita; he'll get what's coming to him." So
yeah, he said that, but then it may be at another time, of course, but I thought, oh, now, and he'll take care of it. And he didn't. There's still time. I did enjoy that after that he has the scene when he's talking with, the detective comes to see him after we, I don't really want to skip to that because I kind of, we're going to lose track of the episode here. I'll get to it in a moment because I want to stick with the flow of the episode.
Okay. I can sort of jump in and tell you where it flowed for me is he tells him to get Otis. He tells Rabbi Milligan to get Otis and meet him at the clubhouse.
Right.
And then we go to Deffy and Otis with right. the fake witness,
which is basically was a scheme of Otis's just to try to get Dickie out of town, get him to go to Chicago, which clearly doesn't work. I think we both have a slight Oliphant bias because of our adoration for his previous work and specifically Deadwood and of course probably even more so Justified. Even his reactions are just so much fun to watch because
yes.
he's clearly aware of what's going on. Not that anyone's doing a really good job here, whether it be the false witness or Otis himself. It's like, yeah, you're not pulling this off, man. And then of course I'm insisting on driving Otis. That moment when Otis is still with the OCD trying to get out of the car, and when he goes, you know, when he says I'll be back in a minute, it's like, is this the minute?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you get an unexpected scene, because there are scenes I expect to see in this episode, you know, like the ones we've had with the confrontation between Giusto and Gaetano, or, you know, the rabbi and Giusto, or later on, a really fine scene between Loy and the rabbi. I did not expect to get a scene at this stage between Dickie and Gaetano. And then we get Constant in the mix as well, who's also, you know, that was very much a, what the fact he's having that scene with him and he still takes out his little thing of carrots to eat.
Yeah.
Cause you'd think he'd be reaching for his badge, but he never bothers to identify himself as a lawman. He just takes out his freaking carrot stick. But, to me, that was just such a fine little funny scene. It made me smile so much.
It was, and then he takes it dark, almost in a Raylan Givens way, where he sort of says something provocative that could almost have inspired them to attack him and then maybe give him the justification to kill them.
That's what I thought he was trying to do. Absolutely.
You know, like trying to, and says very plainly, you know, he knows how to deal with Italians, that they ran him out of Salt Lake City. And I thought, and then he says, I'll be in the car. I'll be there if you need me. You know, but in that, and I think what's funny is they do give him, his delivery is that nice, polite Mormon way that it's not over the top. It's not big. It's not overly menacing. It has just a hint of it. But you can see exactly what he means.
Yes. And now we can get to where I meant to get to before, which is why Otis is there. He's there. He's getting instruction from, Giusto. Basically wants to use him, I guess, to distract the Canon organization. You know, make some arrests, maybe bust some heads, just to get them kind of off their scent and off their back. A bit, which, you know, makes perfect sense that he'd want to use the police that way. And he also wants to send Violante back to New York. He wants him to calm things down with them, make them clear that everything is going smoothly here, but also maybe pick up a few guys. And I love that Violante kind of contradicts him. Like, wait, which is it? Because, you know, one doesn't, you know, necessarily mean the other. And that's when Giusto kind of explodes, like, why is everybody talking back to me?
Yeah.
It's pretty good.
I love that because, and when he turns around, did you get the sense that when he turned around, he was taking a shot of cocaine?
Yes.
Because he has that manic energy when he turns around and explodes. I thought he was turning around and blowing up. He had that immediate cocaine high.
Yep, I thought so. Yeah. I had mentioned, so now we'll get to the Loy and Rabbi scene that comes a little bit later. Now, because I was speculating when we talked about, I guess it was a previous episode, whether the men in I guess it would just be Lemuel and the driver, whether they had any awareness that the rabbi was trying to prevent the shooting, or they just thought he was one of the shooters, period. And it seems to me that that's probably what they thought, but I think Loy believes him in this scene. Even though Loy has makes other comments during the episode about why would we trust him, but I think he believes him. That's the impression I had from that scene.
I did too, and I think Loy believes by the time this is over that by letting him live and saying, protect my son, that in some way he's hoping that because he keeps talking about family, they don't care about you, that in some way that maybe that mercy will help him protect his son too. Because if he kills the rabbi's the only one that he sees any chance of protecting his son. And he talked to him about it before. If he just takes him out, who would be the one that would take care of his son? I think he does believe him, but he makes it clear that if anything happens to Lemuel or his son in the custody of the Fadas, that he'll hold him personally responsible.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, And the competition, it's also, I think, it's a test on a couple different levels. Kind of like what Gaetano did with him. So basically everyone's testing the rabbi, essentially, it seems. And it's not what one might think on the surface, I think, the test would be. Like, oh, I'm going to ask you to bring me back my boy. I'll even give you $5,000. You know, prove yourself to me. It's like, no, I don't think that's what he's doing. I don't think he ever expects that the guy is going to bring him his son, either his money or not. The test is to see how honorable this guy is.
Right.
And if he shows that, then it's like, okay, he's the one person that I know is still going to honor this deal, and his responsibility and mission is to protect his son. And that's why I think he believed that even though it wasn't the son he was in charge, he was charged with, he was still protecting another son of his, you know. So, yeah, that's what I think. Anyway, so what else happened?
Well, there's a part of that I'd like to talk about just for a second, if you don't mind.
I would like it to.
When Loy starts talking about, you know, he about him, what he did to his dad and his people, mm-hmm. and they actually go so far as to flashback to it and actually show the flashback of it. I think we're going to find out that Rabbi Milligan's dad was probably pretty terrible. And, you know, him killing him wasn't him betraying his people per se, but he would rather stay with the Fadas, as indifferent as they are to him, as to return to his father. And so I think that whenever he figures out who the most decent, honorable people are, and we have suspicions based on his name in later seasons of Fargo about that, mm-hmm. I think we understand there's more to tell in that story.
Right. Oh, I mean, I think we've already speculated in previous things. You know, just by the name alone, it's our belief that he will. He may not be able to truly assimilate, you know, in some regards, but we do think he's going to be switching sides once again, which I guess is his thing. You know?
but this time, probably on his own volition and not forcibly.
Right. Yeah. They're not trading a 30 or 40 something year old guy, I guess, at this point. I have no idea how old he's supposed to be. Who knows? He has a haggard look to him, so who knows how old he's supposed to be at this point. So where are we? Oh, so I'd mentioned the laundering money before. So, getting to the point of that, she's actually giving a bag of the money to Thurman Smutney. I don't think it's all the money, but I think it's a good portion of it, because we'd heard mentioned in another episode that was 20,000, I think they got away with.
Yep.
I'm assuming Thurman doesn't owe them 20,000, but, you know, whatever. That's I don't get hung up on the number. Thurman goes and like immediately turns around and he goes to pay the loan back to Loy, you know, with the bag of money. Now, I thought during that scene, and oh, by the way, I'm enjoying all the Chris Rock scenes in this episode. He's kind of becoming a lot of fun to watch. And I think it's also, I love watching a performance when you're trying to figure out what they're thinking. And you can kind of see the wheels turning and you're trying to gauge, you know, especially when you're watching a character that you believe to be a smart character. So it's like, oh, I like seeing the process and now they're trying to figure something out. And I actually thought that Loy was onto him and the money's origins during the scene with him. And then it became clear, no, that doesn't click until he smells the money after he's already walked out the door. So...
yeah, that was a nice touch. And, you know, to sort of touch on the little flourishes this show has, when the trumpet's being played and he's lost in thought, you see the wheels are already turning about everything going on around him. But I thought it was just kind of cool that later when you see, you know, his son come to tell him somebody's at the door. And I like it that there's a white man at the door, which, you know, at that time probably was pretty concerning, not only because of what went on with the Fadas, but just in general as a black man in 1950. But we see Lemuel has a trumpet, and we've heard him talk about being interested in playing jazz music. And then we see the scene, and he's instantly suspicious. And my take on that scene was that he was probably going to watch the mortuary and figure out what had happened. And trace that, but then when he gets the smell, he knows. But I think he thought it was suspicious, but he wasn't sure. Right. If he'd been sure, he'd have killed him.
Right.
But he wasn't sure, and I think, you know, the son of a bitch, he says, is, you know, I should have killed him, because he figures out it was a theft.
Yeah, I mean, someone walks in with a bag of money. It's already, right off the bat, it's going to be suspicious. And even when he tries to say that he'd gotten a check because it was something like money that was left to him because his Uncle Bully had passed away or something like that.
Oh, yeah. He calls it his bequeathment.
Right, his bequeathment. But even so, it's like, okay, let's say you went and you cashed the check. You wouldn't just throw the money in a bag. You know, you'd have it in an envelope. It would be given to you in a neat little stack. Why would you do it? Why, it wouldn't be, and also wouldn't be by random denominations either. So it's part of me thought, Thurman, maybe you could have taken a few minutes just to straighten things out a little bit, you know, neaten it up, put in a goddamn envelope or something so it wouldn't look quite as weirdly suspicious. But, you know, it's, thing, whatever show I'm watching, characters do things without really thinking things out as much as they should have. And actually, as I mentioned, this was a very brisk moving episode, because then we get a little moment at the end where there's, you know, there's actually happiness at the old Smutney household, which is clearly going to be short-lived because the wife already knows what's going on here. So that's going to be a problem. And the fact is, you know, Loy's on to it. It seems like this family is going to continue to be, you know, kind of the unexpected center of so many things going on this show. I mean, I don't know if they're really going to quite qualify for what I was talking about in our first Fargo podcast, how you have to have that the norms at the center somewhere. But it seems like they seem to be having a little bit to do with all these other storylines that are going to revolve around them somehow. And being right. a morgue, they're probably going to get a lot of business over the next few weeks. I'm assuming too.
Well, I will say, I really like the line Loy had to Thurman, where he says, "You know, I thought I'd do this and do that, and I thought I'd just bring it right over." And Loy says, "Well, that's really kind. I can't remember the last time a white man tried to make my life easier." And, you know, in the way he's provoking him to see his reactions, and but I thought, and I have a question for you. This was my thought. We do see Thurman ask Zelmer where they're staying, and they say they're staying at the Le Perry
right.
Hotel, mm-hmm. But we don't see him tell DeBrille that before she leaves. So I have the suspicion she's on her way to Loy's.
Oh boy. Yep. That would make sense. I didn't see any ad. I wasn't able to watch the ad for the next episode. So I don't know if anything hinting at any that popped up there, but, that would be my assumption. How long are they going to stay in town? Once they've done that, there's no reason for them to stay in town. I don't know why. Are they still lingering there maybe because Swanee's not feeling
well? Yeah, Zelmer tells him at the car when she gives him the money that they're going to stick around for a day or two till Swanee feels better, and then they're gone.
And she's asking about the pie.
Made the pie?
So there may be a scene involving that, because she actually asked, was it the nurse? So we may get a little showdown there. Of course, I'd be worried if I were, because goofy version of Nurse Ratched over there, maybe, actually it's not Nurse Ratched, I guess she's more Annie Wilkes, because she's the one with the Angel of Mercy thing. I think she may come out ahead on that one unexpectedly. We shall see. I'm still waiting to see if Jocelyn ever finds out that this woman actually killed his dad. So I still don't think he realizes that. That's what the ring is eventually going to lead to. That's what I'm assuming.
I think that where we differed on that, when I saw that tonight, I came around to your way of thinking that I don't think he realized he set her in motion.
Yeah.
But when he finds the ring, now the interesting possibility is that if Ethel Ryder has the ring, they may think somehow that's attributed to just that family. But the more interesting thing is if for some reason, say Swanee and Zelmir go rob, you know, Orietta and bust in her place and take her trinkets or whatever, and somehow come in possession of that ring, that could be an interesting way for it to go as well. But you know, for you and I think the best thing would be for Josto to figure out Orietta had it. And my guess in Fargo is he'll find out that she has the ring and he'll be planning to kill her, but she will have already poisoned him at that time. That's my crackpot theory, that he'll go to kill her and be under the effects of some poison. And she had quite the arsenal in that closet.
Oh yeah, I absolutely agree. So you beat me to it on that one. Not that I was planning to do the prediction. So it's all you, big man. But
well, if you don't make one, then when I'm wrong, you can just sit back and say I was wrong.
No, I would not. I don't do that. Don't be silly. I don't know if there's really anything else I really wanted to talk about this episode. I mean, it was good. I love the fact. Again, we you know, I mean, even though it was slotted for an hour 22, but it was actually more like an hour 15. It was one of the few times I was actually legitimately surprised. Like, wait, it's over?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
The pacing of this, and it's really impressive with such a big cast. And I will say, twice tonight, strangely enough, I've watched this show a long time. Twice tonight, I was actually retweeted by the actual Fargo page, the official show page. On tweets, I put just, you know, saying I thought it was a great ensemble cast, and I actually replied to one of them and said star studded. And which kind of surprised me, because usually, you know, they might like something or whatever. But I think that when I put that up, my thought at the time was, they moved this a lot, but man, there are a lot of moving pieces. And I felt like this week is the first week that I sort of really know who all the characters are, that I have a handle on who they all are. And they moved a lot of action through all those characters in this episode in a way that it went really quick, but still kept the story cohesive. So, and you know, we left with something big about to happen. I would say next week is going to be the week some real crap hits the fan.
Yeah, well, there's going to have to be some forms of confrontations, but I feel like that each episode is going to have that to a certain extent. If this season although they're doing a very different sort of Fargo season than the previous three. If it at least follows a similar template in terms of the pacing of the overall season, usually it's not even like the final or even the penultimate. It was around the, if I'm recalling other seasons, I think somewhere like the seventh or eighth episode is usually like a big wow kind of an episode. So I could IMDb that and see if I'm right or wrong about that. But I have a feeling that's where they're going to go with all this. Maybe that's when, you know, there could be like the big war or something of that nature. Don't know. I do love the fact that it was so briskly paced, and then I'm thinking of how there were a couple whiny people on Facebook. They don't listen to this podcast, so I don't care if I say call them out for it. They're like, ooh, it's moving too slowly. I can't watch this. I was like, oh, shut the fuck up. You don't know what you're talking about.
I loved it. And if anybody is a big fan, there was a interview with Noah Hawley talking about season four and some of his other projects that I'll try to post to the Serious TV Drama page.
Oh, nice.
I think it was released today. So
was it a Sepinwall interview or just someone else?
It wasn't Sepinwall. It was someone else, but it's actually like a video interview where he talks about season four, possible Star Trek movie, wanting to be involved in the Cat's Cradle project, stuff like that. So I'll try to post a link to that to the page.
Oh, very cool. Alrighty then. All right. So I will start wrapping things up here. There are a few other things I want to talk about as well before we end it completely. But let me start by saying, if you enjoyed this podcast, I'm sure you did. I didn't because my foot hurts, but I did. I'm sure you did. You also enjoy hanging out on our Facebook page. As the aforementioned, by the way, I love the word aforementioned. It's like one of my top 10 favorite words. I don't know why. Serious TV Drama Podcast page. Like the page, and you can join the conversation about shows like Fargo, like The Boys, which is a podcast I'll be recording tomorrow night with Jamie, like Better Call Saul, which is our favorite show, and so many other shows there, and other things. And you can see videos like the one that Brian's apparently going to post at some point tomorrow after I post this podcast there. Speaking of the podcast, you can also find us in Apple Podcasts, where you can subscribe to our feed, and you can also rate and review us there. You can go to our podcast hosting page, which is stvdpodcast.podbean.com, and you can access all 275 of our podcasts there. It's fascinating when you start sifting through the older episodes, and just the way things are even posted is odd and different and wacky and weird. But you can click on an old one and you hear, look how happy Dan was. or back when we used to have other people guest appear and stuff, or whatever, or when we talked about more than one show. So you can go there, and how, like I've always said, you can just Google, you know, Serious TV Drama Podcast or STV Podcast. You can find us a bunch of other places, you know, be one of the few who actually listens to us on YouTube. Why? That is it. Oh, Twitter. You can also, and our Twitter handle is at STVD Podcast. That's STVD as in Serious TV Drama Podcast. So as I said, some of you will be listening to us Monday morning after I post it. I hope to be recording the final Boys podcast with Jamie Monday evening, which means we will try to get that out to y'all Tuesday morning. And then, well, let's see. This injury, I'm hoping will not affect my brain any as far as getting ready for a future podcast. Beyond recording with Brian, you, next Sunday, the next Fargo one, getting ready to start up the project I said that's going to carry on for the rest of this year and into the first month or two of next year, which I am referring to as the greatest TV drama episodes of all time or something. I might even put them differently in our thing, in our feed. It'll be fascinating. People are like, hey, it doesn't say Serious TV Drama Podcast 278. It says STVD Podcast, because I need to save room. So I have already said that the first episode of that will be released on October 20. What did I say? I think October 23rd. October 23rd. Which means I better get cracking on lining up my co-hosts and shit. I will announce on the podcast page what number 20 is. So, you know, a week, I will always try to announce them a week in advance so folks can go and track down whatever the episode is of a TV show. Most, if not all, I'm hoping all, I haven't checked them all out yet, they should all be streaming somewhere. You should either be able to find them, either be Netflix or Hulu or Amazon or Amazon Prime or something wacky like YouTube or whatever the hell, wherever else, you know. Hopefully you guys won't have to pay to watch it. If you do, considering how much money you pay for the podcast, you know, boohoo. I'm sorry you had to spend $3. I'm so sorry. Yeah, but that's what I plan to start. So if the podcast is going to be on the 23rd, So that means by October 16th, I should make an announcement on the STBD page as to what number 20 is. And I, like, as I've said before, I will not be revealing the entire list all at once. You guys will just have to wait week for week to see what number 19 or 18 or 17 is. So that way I don't have to deal with people whining and bitching about, I don't understand why I just went my PD blue. One person. Now I hope he doesn't listen to this podcast, because I did not mean to. I don't know why I said it in my PD blue.
It's the Percocet, people. It's the Percocet.
Yeah, it's the Percocet. Right. I should have went with BSG. Like, hey, Dan, I got bad news. I decided BSG is not in the novel. I think it will be. It just might not be the episode we think. Anyway, so I'll stop there. So, again, Brian, thanks for joining me this evening. Thanks for helping to carry the freight here, because between my doziness and the Percocet and the pain, I'm not sure how much I was able to contribute. Fortunately for the boys listeners, I actually wrote up all those notes this morning, so I should have a little bit more. But if I'm in a lot of pain, then Jamie's going to have to do more. We shall see. It's a cliffhanger.
Well, Scott, thanks for sticking in there. I know you're in a lot of pain, and I enjoyed it and look forward to next week.
I'm glad you enjoyed my pain.
No, I enjoyed the podcast.
I know. I love the way it sounded. It was perfect. I know you're in a lot of pain. I enjoyed it, and wow. You know, you're doing such a good job replacing, filling in for... You'll never listen to this either. Who cares? All right. So, like I said, thanks so much for joining. Good night to you, and good night to everybody out there.
Bye.